The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, I was thinking a lot about our conversation yesterday and the comments that people were making, particularly about how expensive it is in Israel. Everybody seems to find it very expensive. And of course, prices here are high. It's not only the inflation that we are suffering at the moment, but also because obviously of the strength of the shekel, and particularly when coming from a country where the currency to a basket of international currency is quite weak, Israel has a very, very strong currency. And so obviously the impact of the huge the massive prices that we are forced to pay here is exacerbated as a result of that. But let's think about, I don't know if anybody's heard about Bidna Naish. Bidna Naish is an Arabic term for we want to live. And Bidna Naish is a movement that is growing up and has grown up in Gaza against the economic impact of what's going on there. And it's very fascinating that this is a movement that's growing up and has come to the fore again over the past few weeks. It originally initiated back in 2009, came out of the Jabalia refugee camp as a protest, as an online protest against economic hardships, and also as something of a protest against the leadership who seem to be living a relatively comfortable life, many of them even basing the center of their existence outside of Gaza, and yet the people in Gaza suffering all manner of economic hardships, not able to earn a living, prices going up, electricity and water supply intermittent, and people suddenly woke up and decided, Bidna Naish, we want to live. And this has come out on the social media as well. Interestingly, the leadership have cracked down very, very heavily on this. They don't tolerate this kind of protest. And in fact, many of the leaders of the Bidna Naish movement have even been expelled from the Gaza Strip and are operating from abroad. But it's been quite fascinating to watch that many of the leaders who were held to account because they are living abroad alongside their families, obviously benefiting a lot from much of the international aid that is coming into Gaza, which is really supposed to be for the downtrodden people who can't seem to earn a living. It seems as if a lot of that is going to the leadership and funding their existence abroad. Many of them have been forced to return to Gaza very publicly to show that they're back and they're living in Gaza as opposed to living abroad. Of course, Israel is being blamed, as you would expect. This is all about the occupation, the usual terminology that we've come to expect. But clearly, the economic impact not only being felt in Israel and elsewhere around the world where we have supply chain problems and inflationary pressures and things like that, but Bidna Naish is apparently a thing.
Amazing. And it's incredible that this movement is growing, and I think very, very important as well. U.S. mediator Avi Hochstein has made an unannounced stop in Israel after discussions with the Lebanese government. Does this mean that a deal is close?
I think so. But then I thought that a deal was close some time ago. Mm-hmm. And the more we hear about it, the more I feel that this could have been done in an hour. This really could have just been closed down and sorted out, because the deal that is currently being spoken about is, as far as I'm aware, the same deal that was always on the table, which says you take this piece, which also straddles the border, and we'll take that piece, which straddles the border. So you're giving up on a little and we're giving up on a little, and we'll come to an agreement. And in this particular case, the Karish gas field is being claimed by Israel, and the Israeli government is willing to give over the Qana gas field to Lebanon, which also straddles the zone. It's called Sidon in Hebrew, that particular gas field, but the Lebanese know it as the Qana gas field. And end of story. Everybody signs up and begins to do what they need to do and goes home happy. And yet it's just continuing on, and threats of war from Hezbollah and visits by Avi Hochstein, who fascinatingly is an Israeli living in the USA, and he has been the envoy to negotiate this. He's given this title as senior advisor for energy security That's his official title from the U.S. administration. But it just seems like the deal was always there to be done. And yet there is just all this backwards and forwards and mediation and threats and people, you know, jumping up and down and you know, all kinds of unnecessary things happening, which I think could easily have been avoided. So I'm not quite sure if this is a situation where the dance is more important than the outcome. The actions, the allowing Hezbollah to vent their frustration and make their threats. I'm not sure if that's part of the deal, that they need to do that before we can finally come to an agreement and then sign up and go home. Avi Hochstein yesterday met with Prime Minister Yair Lapid. Today he's due to meet with other members of the Israeli government. He seemed to be very optimistic. When he was in Beirut, had met with senior Lebanese officials, the spokesman from the State Department confirmed that, you know, things are going well, that that Avi had been in touch with the U.S. administration on events that went down in Lebanon. And it seems as if though, there is a deal to be done here. I just wonder whether there's still more to this dance that we need to go through before they finally agree to sign on to what seems to me to be the most obvious thing in the world and which is on the table. As I understand it, when Avi Hochstein arrived in Lebanon, he was bringing a proposal that had been made by Israel to the Lebanese officials. And as I understand things, Lebanese officials were quite willing to accept that proposal, but I'm guessing there might have been a few little tweaks to be made, and hence his stop in Israel in order to try to resolve things. It's not clear whether or not he will be returning to Lebanon at this stage, but in his statement that he made to the press, he said that he would have to come back to the region in order to finalize the agreement. So we all hope that soon after Tisha B'Av, which is of course a more appropriate time to come to final agreements, that we can finally put an end to all of this. All the threats can be dissipated. The threat of the northern border can somewhat be reduced. And of course the gas from the Karish gas field can be extracted in peace and security for the benefit not only of Israel and of course economically to Israel, but of course to the benefit of Europe and to the benefit of the Lebanese people, who will also be enjoying the fruits of that particular gas field.
Absolutely. Let's hope that that is resolved. Talks between Russia and Israel on the issue of the Jewish agency activities in Russia seems to have reached a dead end. This is just a terrible story. What does this mean for the Jewish agency?
Well, it's not a good story. And of course, it's not very favorable for Israel's relationship with Russia. And so a delegation from the Foreign Affairs Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been in Russia this week. And their discussions were being held with also people from within the government, from the technocrats within the government, rather than with, let's say, decision makers from the political echelon. And I think that therein lies some of the issue, that this seems to be a matter that's being driven by the politicians rather than by the public servants. And all the while that Israel is sending these delegations to talk to public servants, there's really not going to be any progress, because it seems, as I've said, that all of the decisions and the instructions are really coming from the top down. So the discussions between the members of the Russian government, the public servants from within the Russian administration, and members of Israel's diplomatic corps, who particularly traveled to Moscow in order to meet with representatives of the Russian Ministry of Justice. There was quite an extensive foreign ministry delegation that went from Israel, and they had their discussions, and they tried somehow to unblock these issues and to talk about the legal challenge, the letter that was sent by the court, which effectively put an end to Jewish agency activities in Russia, at least for now. They discussed that. There was no decision reached. There was no no attempt to try to reschedule meetings for the future in order to continue the discussion. It just kind of seemed to come to an end. and nothing more to say and nothing more to do. Now, the next action will happen on the 19th of August, when this is due to come before the Russian court. The matter is due to be held, to be heard in front of a Russian court in Moscow, which will consider this lawsuit, which was actually filed by the Russian Ministry of Justice concerning the liquidation of the Jewish Agency office in Russia. So that hearing will take place in another 2 weeks, approximately from now, 2 weeks on Friday. And until then, it seems like not a great deal can be done or achieved other than to wait for the court hearing to take place. Another little problem alongside this is the fact that Russia has in the meantime expanded its definition of what it calls foreign agents. And now under the new definition, the foreign agents also include those who take part in any activity that authorities determine goes against Russia's national interests, or who receive support of any kind, not just money, from abroad. And it seems to me that this definition has potentially been designed also to capture the Jewish Agency, but it certainly seems that it does capture the Jewish Agency, and that the Jewish Agency could be termed as a so-called foreign agent under Russian law. Of course, this doesn't help their activities at all. So behind the scenes, members of the Jewish Agency are trying to work out what they're going to be doing in order to support Jewish community in Russia, particularly those people who might wish to consider coming to Israel. I think that they've considered the possibility of opening up a Russian Jewish agency office in Israel in order to somehow help from afar as much as is possible. But this clearly is not a good sign for relationships between Israel and Russia.
No, not at all, and very worrying, of course, for the Jews in the country. The right-wing religious Zionist parties seem to be edging closer to an agreement prior to the upcoming elections. And Anthony, we've spoken about this a number of times, but it's really bothering me more and more that as much as I'm reading about Israeli politics coming up with the elections, I'm just not reading anything about ideas, issues, debates around the future. It's really very, very much about petty politics, party politics. Am I wrong? Am I missing something?
I think that this is really all about individuals even more than petty party politics. I think it's all about, on the one hand, attempts to return former Prime Minister Netanyahu to the seat of the Prime Minister, or the alternative to prevent him from returning to become prime minister. I think that that's really a lot of what this is about. It was interesting that Ayelet Shaked, when she did her deal with Yoaz Hendel to create Haruach HaTzioni, the Zionist spirit coalition that will run together in the upcoming election. I mentioned that I didn't feel that they'd come up with anything positive and that they'd really spoken a lot about what they didn't want rather than what they do want. But it was interesting that Ayelet Shaked, as the leader of Haruach HaTzioni, made a comment which one cannot ignore. And even though she was very much against the idea of supporting what she called a narrow coalition that would put former Prime Minister Netanyahu back in the pound seat, she also then went on to say that one cannot ignore a million people who vote for the Likud. So what she's really trying to say is that the largest block of people who vote in Israel vote for the Likud. It's a million people out of a total population of almost 10 million. So in terms of the number of people who are entitled to vote, a relatively high percentage, or at least the highest percentage. And her view is that one cannot simply ignore them. And therefore, you can infer from that that you can't ignore former Prime Minister Netanyahu and his quest to come back to office. And therefore, we can infer further that she may well be willing to support him coming back into office, so long as she can somehow justify that it's not the so-called narrow coalition that she was so much against, but it's a much broader coalition, but at least, you know, the million people are not being ignored. And so too, this agreement that seems to be in offering between Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, who are the two extreme right-wingers on the religious Zionist spectrum, and two very, very outspoken, very, very strong personalities who don't seem to be able to sit together in a confined space because of the strength of each of their personalities. But last time around did run and together and did manage to secure, I believe, six seats or seven, maybe eight seats, I'm sorry, in the previous election. I need to just check on that number, but they did manage to gain a good number of seats in the previous election. But because of the strength of their characters and because of the way in which each of them operate, they just don't seem to sit well together. The issue is that Smotrich and his party are on the edge of potentially not getting through the minimum electoral threshold. And so they are, by them coming together, it seems as if they might be able to secure as many as 10 seats on a combined basis, whereas it seems as if they're from the polls that we've seen up until now, that Ben-Gvir might be able to secure 7 or 8. So it would certainly be an extra a few seats beyond what they might be able to get, each one running separately. And again, this is very, very good for the Netanyahu camp, because it would be, they would certainly support him coming in as prime minister, and they would certainly join a coalition. So this is good news. The ink is not dry yet on the agreement, and there still will no doubt be a lot of elbows out in negotiation before the ink is finally dried on the agreement. But I can't see a situation where they won't agree, even though the agreement will come with many, many disagreements. The two of them are just, you know, have their own way of dealing with things. Very, very difficult to put them together. But I think that they both realize that this is for the benefit of each of them individually, and in the for the benefit of their ideology. To promote it, and gives the Netanyahu camp much needed boost in the arm in terms of the possibility of getting him back into office.
Yep, very, very interesting. Anthony, before I let you go, I want to read you a message from a listener, and I'd love to be able to maybe turn this into a conversation tomorrow. We're coming up for the anniversary of the withdrawal of Israel from Gush Katif. It was a move that was meant to usher in peace. What's happened since then, and what has happened to the land that was Gush Katif? So maybe we can talk about that tomorrow as we come up for this anniversary.
Let's do that, and I'd like to encourage people to write in before we even talk about it, about their views, because it's not an easy discussion even now looking back. Usually they say it's easy to look back on history and to draw conclusions. This particular one still has so many differing views on whether it was the right or the wrong thing to do. I've certainly got a strong view on it, so let's talk about it tomorrow. I look forward to it, and we'll also talk about the Tisha B'Av, which is coming up over the weekend.
It is 8:01. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. We'll catch you tomorrow morning at 7:45.